Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guest, in this case, someone I've had before, Major, retired Major Danny Shorson, a guy who went from West Point to Iraq to Afghanistan, spent 18 years in the military, seen the worst of these forever wars. And I wanted him on now because I read an article, an interview in the New Yorker, Isaac Chotiner, with David Petraeus. And David Petraeus somehow, well, let me just read the lead of the article. David Petraeus, the retired four-star Army general, served in the military for nearly four decades, eventually becoming the most famous and revered member of the armed forces during the War on Terror and the war in Iraq, known for developing a new theory of counterinsurgency, which emphasized winning the support of civilians rather than seizing territory. Petraeus was placed in charge of all troops in Iraq by President George Bush in 2007 and oversaw the Cold War surge of forces, which, by the way, Major Danny participated in. And then the reason I'm asking you about him is he now says in this interview that it's premature to have gotten Afghanistan. He believes the U.S., according from the New Yorker, he believes the U.S. should have remained in Afghanistan and gave a full-throated defense of an active military presence aboard. What do you make of all this? You've read the New Yorker interview, I'm sure.
Well, thanks for having me on again, Bob. And this article and this interview is an exercise in absurdity. I mean, it's almost a cartoonish depiction of himself by himself. From the start, the entire idea and the entire tone is one of like somebody who has realized that his ideas are kind of tired and they've been kind of battered intellectually. And he sounds like someone who's kind of on the intellectual hyper defensive. But now, because there was a mess in Afghanistan in the withdrawal, which was going to be inevitable to a certain extent. I mean, on some level, it was going to be a messy thing. Even Fareed Zakaria said there's, no elegant way to lose a war. He then comes out and sort of touts all the old hits that never worked. Petraeus was my commander twice. He was way up the chain, but he commanded both of the wars that I was in and both of the surges. I got a pretty good sense of what he was putting out there and what he thought would work. And essentially none of it did, not in the long term. So it's fascinating when you read the opening to that you just mentioned, known for developing a new theory of counterinsurgency. Well, of course, the theory that he brought together and put into this manual was neither new nor successful, past or present. And it would be more accurate to say that he revamped and twisted an old, discredited theory of counterinsurgency, which never created any of the long-term gains it promised, less so in Afghanistan than Iraq. And it didn't work in Iraq, or we wouldn't have had ISIS. And, it goes on to say how he's this revered member of the military. And it's true that a cult of Petraeus did sort of arise, especially in 2007 through maybe 2011. But then he resigns from his post in 2012 for providing the classified information to his mistress and all this. But what is the most interesting, and we can dig into some of the details, is that these are the same tired arguments that kept us in Afghanistan, kept us in Iraq, and are still keeping us in other places around the world that people don't talk about for 20 years. And it's the guys like him with lots of medals on their chest who are fairly articulate, and are willing to just kind of spout platitudes at you that keep these things going. And this is a guy who also said he sees Afghanistan as a generational war. He said that about 3 or 4 years ago. Of course, his soldiers, right, that he talks about how much he loves them and, he tells stories about what it was like to lead men, they're all out of step with him because about 3/4 of them support full withdrawal from Afghanistan. So he's bargaining with their lives, essentially, and I find it pretty grotesque.
Well, let me – you dropped something in there. He came in – he was disgraced, really, and yet survived somehow. He's now – here's the New Yorker, which, by the way, has recently specialized in outing people for their poor behavior, personal behavior, troubles with the law, and so forth, and yet revered. And they have sort of a casual little mention that he have had a problem with giving information to his mistress. But that was really, he was head of the CIA. And these were the black books, the briefing books, the top secrets that we had. He got a slap in the wrist. He admitted to having material, but not for obstructing justice, not for lying to the FBI, which he did. And somehow he gets off scot-free. And yet you have people, you know, one of them is not a U.S. citizen, Julian Assange, who's in jail at the request of now of the Biden administration. You had, whistleblowers, really, you know them all. I should have mentioned you're head of this Eisenhower Institute now. You're involved with quite a few vets that have tried to tell the truth about things. Isn't there something appalling that the double standard that this guy could have turned over the most top secret information to his mistress and somehow is still revered?
Well, it really does prove that accountability is utterly lacking in certain quarters. And it is amazing to me that in an ostensible republic or democracy, that the generals should be the people who are beyond reproach. That's actually the inversion of what most of the founding fathers were writing, you know, their fear of standing armies, fear of like professionalized military officer corps. And yet the generals are essentially untouchable. There is always a soft military industrial complex, direct or linked, like strategic consultancy landing place for all these generals, even the ones who get in trouble while they're in uniform or in their civilian jobs afterwards. So of course, you know, there's the mention of him being a convicted criminal, right, for doing two things that if his own soldiers or junior officers below him had done would be game changers. I mean, it just life altering, destroyed careers, really difficult to come back from. I mean, if one of his soldiers had done those things, even a mid-range officer, they would never have gotten such a light. And then they wouldn't be a partner in the global investment firm KKR and chairman of the KKR Global Institute, among other things. That's just one thing that's mentioned. It's the same length of how they described his crime in this bio. So it shows that there's no accountability. But you know what else? There's no accountability for losing and lying about losing a war, or in his case, two. And I think these wars were hopeless. And so I wouldn't say that, okay, the generals were solely responsible for losing this, that they should have been able to take Normandy Beach, but they didn't flank correctly. It's not like that. What they didn't do was stand up to the civilians and at least speak their mind and say, this can't be done. They weren't honest with their superiors. They certainly weren't honest with their soldiers, and they weren't honest with the American people, which of course, the Afghanistan papers, which really is the Pentagon papers of our time, but got almost no attention and comparatively to what happened back then. We know this to be true. But these generals, there's no accountability for losing and lying about wars. And back in 2006 or 7, Colonel Paul Yingling, that I know some, and he was a battalion commander in Iraq, just before Petraeus took over, and he wrote that as it stands today, and by the way, he didn't make general, so surprise, surprise. He wrote in the Armed Forces Journal, official publication of the military, said, as it stands today, a private who loses his rifle stands to lose more or get punished more than a general who loses a war. And that has proven true, and General Petraeus is the perfect kind of description of that, in the sense that anytime he wants to write in the Washington Post, he can. Anytime he wants to get interviewed in the New Yorker, he can. If he wants to show up on CNN, he can. But as you know, was written in a Washington Post editorial by Katrina, right? That who we both know some. The people who got this right, you know, they can't get there. And I'll admit that she listed my name, so that come off as self-aggrandizing. But there's a lot of people on that list. There are dozens of people who've been right about Afghanistan, have been right about Iraq. And they can't get a column in the Washington Post. They can't get on MSNBC. But these war industry lackey revolving door generals, they absolutely can. And here is David Petraeus being given the space in the New Yorker to spout the same discredited myths which we could go through because he lists them out. But it's really, it's an indicator, and I think it's instructive about the nature of the civil-military relationship and the politicized generals, and it kind of exposes how this continues. This is people like Petraeus are the front men helping to grease the wheels of these forever wars.
Well, you keep raising so many points that I want to explore further, but you talk about his relationship to the global investment firm KKR. That's a firm that had almost $4.88 billion in income in 2020. It's a firm that manages $216 billion of assets. And here, Petraeus, after being forced out of the CIA in a scandal, major scandal, not major punishment, but major scandal, he ends up being hired. Now, he works for KKR, and he's the head of their global institute. And yet this doesn't appall people. You know, they don't challenge him on it. I mean, here's this fawning New Yorker profile that just talks about as the most admired person. But tell us about that reality. You were commanded by him. You went to the same West Point. You know a great deal about this. What is this phenomenon that David Halberstam first described in relation to Vietnam of the best and the brightest? Because Petraeus is definitely a bright fellow. He got his doctorate, et cetera, et cetera. What is it about these people? They're just brilliant at being disingenuous?
You know, that's a really interesting phenomenon. And I think that, you know, Halberstam's book was really interesting digging into this. Some of the other analyses of this, some of it does have the feel of, like, you know, the psychological, trying to understand it. But it does seem that folks like Petraeus, from kind of a very early point in their career, if you actually follow his background, were really always kind of climbers, you know, company men, but who want to raise to the top of the company. They are sort of passed along from one mentor to the other. Everyone stays in line. Nobody really questions anything. He's smarter than your average bear, so he's very capable of moving forward. But what I think is really lacking in gentlemen like him is this sense of like a moral principle surrounding their duty to the American people. I mean, your duty isn't just to the United States Army as an institution. I mean, they will spout lies. They will massage the facts. They, you know, they will advocate for forever war that might kill their fellow, you know, alumni from West Point or their soldiers who were enlisted. And there's never any accountability for it. And then when it's all over with, they join the same club with the generals who came before them. And that club is the military-industrial complex, or its tangentially linked spokes from the military-industrial complex wheel. So they all go work for strategic consultancies or on the board of actual war industry, you know, merchants of death I'm talking about. We're talking Raytheon, we're talking Lockheed. And everyone welcomes them with open arms, as if nothing happened. Meanwhile, like I had said, the soldiers under my command in Afghanistan who were killed did so for $30,000 to $40,000 a year, and there is no revolving door for them. The revolving door, in some cases, is to a wheelchair. In other cases, is to a lifetime, in many cases, of emotional trauma, mental health. Or maybe it's to a factory, or maybe it's to a Walmart job, or maybe it is to something, you know, that some college or the GI Bill, there are programs. But the statistics will tell you that there's no revolving door for the people who do the fighting. There is no revolving door for them. So the whole system is built to maintain acquiescence. If you speak out of turn and are a principled 2 or 3 or 4 star general, first of all, you probably won't get there. You probably won't make that rank. But if you do, and then you speak out of turn, if you pull a half a Smedley Butler, right, the Marine general in the 1930s who writes War is a Racket and is going on speaking tours, if you pulled 1/10 of that even, you're not welcome in the club. And the club might be a 7-figure job on a war industry board or in one of these strategic consultancies that essentially is linked to them. And then those same people, the former generals, that's one conflict, who are now on the war in the war industry, in the military industrial complex, the second conflict, are the same people who are appointed to give advice to the president on things like the Afghan study group, or are unofficially giving public advice on CNN. So it's the whole system, and it locks out most people. And instead, these same insiders control the narrative even after they're out of uniform. And I think that the Petraeus case is instructive because I think it shows how the system works through the anecdotal of David Petraeus and what I think has always been a snake oil salesman when it comes to this counterinsurgency. If you read his lessons, which I guess we can get into at some point, if you read what he actually argues, it is exceedingly easy to deflate every one of his myths, because this interview is a platitude factory of discredited fantasies.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest. Well, take us through that, because I think this is important. But before we do that, I just want to get to this integrity thing. I mean, you have people, yourself included, no one charged you with any kind of misbehavior, but John Kiriakou, for instance, who was in the CIA that Petraeus took over, and he informed the public, first in New York Times, actually, about torture. He was the first one, really, to expose the torture that had become commonplace in the CIA and so forth. And he was destroyed, effectively, had to serve time. But you could go down the list, not a long list, unfortunately, of whistleblowers. And here is Petraeus. Tell us what he did. Those books were books, the black books, were designed for the hearing of the eyes only of the president. He gave them to his mistress. Compare that to what the whistleblowers were accused of doing.
Right. It seems to me that if your leak, right, if you're, you know, if what you leaked, assuming that the whistleblowers do that, because, you know, there's different ways to blow the whistle, but if your leak is in the public interest, if that's the motive, your punishment will actually be more, traditionally, than if the leak was something which, I mean, he's giving it to his biographer, who is also the woman he's having an affair with. And that's reckless and dangerous.
Oh, by the way, the reason this came out is she, in the words of the person who was called, who worked for him, was attempting to blackmail him. And that's how the FBI learned about it. And then he even lied blatantly to the FBI about what had been going on. So this, you know, I mean, goodness sake, you got these people whose whole lives have been destroyed, some of whom are serving hard time. You got somebody like Julian Assange, who wasn't even an American involved with all this, being imprisoned at the request of both Donald Trump and now Joe Biden, President Biden. And yet here is Petraeus, who comes out of this smelling wonderfully. What kind of deodorant is this that they have? It's startling.
I mean, it really is. When we got briefings, you know, I wasn't a CIA agent or anything, but even in the military, officers and soldiers too get briefings on like how to avoid, you know, what to look for in terms of being, you know, influenced by foreign agents or something. You know, you have to go through these PowerPoint presentations or watch these videos. And I mean, it's like 101. It's like avoid blackmail 101. They always bring that up, you know, that the possibility of, you know, some foreign citizen, particularly a woman in some cases, you know, in these mostly male units, you know, being able to blackmail you, even when you try to get your top secret clearance, which, you know, is a fairly high clearance, but it's not the top of the top, you know, they always talk about that. They go through your past to look and see if there's anything that can be used to blackmail you, because that's a liability. So in some ways, General Petraeus had, or, you know, director at that point, Petraeus had walked into like the classic trap, and was that's a real risk. And so this was a serious offense. And again, it seems that the punishment in the military and in the intelligence agencies actually decreases as you go higher up in the rank, which is why when we had things like the torture scandals at Abu Ghraib, okay, who took the fall? Sergeants, specialists, some lieutenants and captains lost their job, and like one brigadier general in the reserves got, you know, demoted to colonel or something. All it always flows down, and that's an old cliche, but it's extraordinarily dangerous, because if we don't hold people like Petraeus accountable, he will continue to get a hearing, and he gets a hearing in the most mainstream, widely, you know, viewed and read and listened to sources. But what he's spreading is discredited poison, and he says there are actually five lessons from the last 20 years of war, if you want to hear them. Like, he has like a snarky petulance to this entire thing. When you read the article, I'm sure you felt the same or got that same sense. He definitely has like a petulance to him. You know, he really wants to get this out. He wants to feel vindicated because he feels like the critics of the war have been getting the better of the Hawks for a while. But actually what he could say, if he was being accurate, is there are actually, instead of five lessons, five myths and discredited delusions, because what he lays out is it really doesn't bear a lot of resemblance to the reality either on the ground or strategically across the world right now.
Well, the interesting thing with Petraeus is he actually was not a combat veteran in the sense that he came in after Vietnam, or at the tail end, and then he, of course, had been on the highest level. You were on the ground. You started out of West Point as a lieutenant out there in Iraq, and you were there, actually. You wrote an excellent book on the surge while you were still in the service. And then you were sent to Afghanistan and then participated there. Tell us about, because this whole, it's not just the New Yorker, that whole, they're going to now battle and say, no, again, it's like Vietnam. We got out prematurely, as if there's a proper way to get out, you know, and that's always their argument. You can't just get out, you know. And that's what's happening now. We got to keep fighting these wars. We got to keep having these interventions, and we'll do it right the next time. And here he's even saying, astounding, really, in this, and not challenged by the journalists in the New Yorker, really, that no, we needed to stay longer. And you were there on the ground in both Iraq and in Afghanistan under his command, and you rose to be a major, so you got to a high level. Let's talk about. Got another 8-9 minutes here. Let's talk about the fallacy of this thinking. If you think it's totally fallacious, I don't know.
Oh, it's wildly fallacious. It's insultingly fallacious. And forget about me myself. Like, I'm in a lot of ways, I'm almost over it. You know, but I think about the people who serve under my command, who were even more in the trenches. You know, at 19 years old, and some of whom didn't make it. This is insulting. You know, and it just going down the line, you're right about the reporter not really challenging him. I mean, there's like little questions he'll ask, but he never really asks the hard ones. So there, you know, Isaac Chotiner says, how did we not prepare for all this in 20 years? In other words, why did it all just collapse so quick? And Petraeus says, I just think it was premature to leave. I mean, he is stretching the English language there to its breaking point, the definition of premature at 20 years. And then he comes in and says the five lessons from the last 20 years of war. Well, what he really misses is there's one lesson that he completely misses, and then I'll break down the next five quickly. And it's this, that the problem was the occupation, that the problem was American militarism, that in Afghanistan in particular, America's military occupation and the corruption of the government they put in place and the perception that that government was an American lackey, by putting more soldiers in, by flooding the district with armed foreigners in the villages, yes, it might keep the Taliban from taking the big cities for 10 years, for 20 years. Maybe it would have been held for 30 if we left enough soldiers there. But what it did really is it fueled the resistance. We made the Taliban into the national resistance movement that they always styled themselves to be, bolstering their narrative, giving them the cornering of the market on resistance and what it is to be a truly nationalistic, a real Afghan compared to those, you know, elites in Kabul who were really just, you know, stooges of the Americans. Whether all of that narrative is precisely correct, I'm certainly not taking the Taliban's narrative at, you know, hook, line, and sinker, but that's the effect. The militarization, the occupation is the problem. Petraeus never, ever mentions in this interview or anything I've ever seen him write or say that maybe the problem is American militarism abroad. Maybe we shouldn't have gone to these places. But instead, he'll give us the five well-worn tired myths. And it's like, you know, for anybody who's been paying attention to these issues for a long time or following the arguments for these wars, I'd say, you know, stop me if you've heard this before, a little tongue-in-cheek, because it's every platitude ever. Number one, he says the five lessons from the last 20 years of war. The first is that Islamist extremists will exploit ungoverned spaces to do, you know, terrorism. So that's the safe haven myth, you know, the ungoverned spaces, the idea that so long as there is a corner of the planet or even part of a country in some corner of the planet that is chaotic or doesn't have strong central government, that makes it a threat to the homeland. Of course, by that logic, we would have to institute a draft and bring in probably an even higher percentage of our citizenry than World War II, because there will always be ungoverned spaces. And it's just impossible that we would go and, you know, put our soldiers and remake these societies and, you know, through counterinsurgency the way Petraeus seems to be asking for. Furthermore, the 9/11 attacks may have been ordered from Afghanistan, but that's not really where they crafted the logistics and made it happen. That was done in, you know, Virginia, Florida, San Diego, Hamburg, Germany, right? This terrorism can happen anywhere, and there is no possible way to police every corner of the globe. In fact, the act of chasing it is what fuels more local terrorism, destabilizes more countries with active Islamist insurgencies. So one could argue, as Spencer Ackerman does in his new book, Reign of Terror, that the problem post 9/11 wasn't terrorism. America's problem wasn't terrorism. What was hurting America wasn't terrorism. It was counterterrorism. So that's the first one. And then quicker on the other ones because they're pretty simple. Number two, he says, lesson number two is you actually have to do something about the problem itself. You have to do something because what happens doesn't stay there. So he's saying you've got to be active. You got to be proactive. America has to be forward in the world. That's what he argues in that paragraph. Actually, I would propose a do less strategy because the facts say, the statistics say, that in every single theater where the United States has committed significant military force, the number of Islamist groups, the number of attacks by what they call VEOs, violent extremist organizations, has actually exploded. In every instance, we have been wildly counterproductive. Now, you could point to ISIS and say that we were able to roll back the caliphate with local help on the ground. And that is true, largely because ISIS decided to fight like an army, fairly conventionally. Of course, we killed a lot of civilians in the process, and it was messy, and we certainly haven't stabilized that region. But if you look at Africa, if you look at Afghanistan, if you look at Iraq before that, because ISIS is an outgrowth of America's war, everywhere we've touched with our military has exploded with the very thing that we were trying to get rid of, we said. And I think that fuels a lot of conspiracy thinking. You know, I don't buy into that, but you could see why it would. The third one is just that we have to lead. America has to lead. Again, our track record shows that I don't know why anyone would follow us. We've destabilized the world, essentially, from Morocco to Central Asia. And the fourth is, you can't just do counterterrorism. You have to do big, broad counterinsurgency. That's because that's what he did. Of course, it worked in neither Iraq or Afghanistan in the long term. Neither of his surges achieved long-term stability, and yet he wants more of that. And then his final one is you got to use the local forces and not ours because you got to keep the casualties down. And he even says he basically admits what Nixon did. He admits what Nixon would say behind closed doors about getting rid of the draft. He says if you get American casualties down sufficiently, then you won't see people demonstrating in the streets the way we did in the last five or more years of the Vietnam War. So in other words, it's so cynical. He's saying, look, we got to stay engaged everywhere. We got to keep fighting forever, generational war. But as long as we use proxies and drones, he says at one point, you can never have enough reapers. He literally says that in the article. Then the American people won't notice, or at least they won't care enough to get in the streets and try to stop it. It's the most cynical interview I've read in a very long time.
So just to end this on a note of cynicism, you say he got involved, came out of West Point and was post-Vietnam or the last end of it. And there had been lessons about Vietnam, about getting involved. And in fact, all the predictions turned out to be wrong. Vietnam is now our happy capitalism outsourcing center that we're holding up as a rival to communist China, two communist countries. But we prefer Vietnam to China, I guess, at least under President Trump, and seems to be under Joe Biden. Let's move the production from communist China to communist Vietnam. So none of the predictions turned out to be true. In the case of Vietnam, there's a particular irony, and I haven't mentioned your history book. I hope you make reference to it right now in the question I give you. But there's a broad sweep in your own writing about it, and I commend it to people. You discuss the origins of the Afghan war. And the fact is, Al-Qaeda was not natural to Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda was a result of American policy there. And the policy was, ironically, to give the Russians, who were allied with a government that was in Afghanistan, their Vietnam. Those were the words of Zbigniew Brzezinski, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. We backed the Mujahideen, the Islamic fanatics in Afghanistan. And when we couldn't find enough of them, we helped import them from the Arab world. So why don't we end this thing with really talking about the ironies of history? Here's a man, General Petraeus, whose life spans from Vietnam through Iraq to Afghanistan. And the lesson is, you are not the solution to the problem, I think. You are the creator of the problem. That's what happened with Afghanistan. It was not a bed of worldwide insurrection until our government, our CIA, our military experts started this way back in the 1970s. First of all, give us the name of your history book.
True History of the United States. It's really easy to find everywhere. I cover Vietnam in a chapter. I talk a little bit about this. And I think it's important to go back, and it can be done pretty briefly. Look, one of the things that's constantly said is we have to stay because of women's rights, human rights, and democracy. We're going to lose those gains. And while there may be some losses in some of the urban centers where there was a little more stability, and I take that seriously, and I feel actually rather awful about it, even if I don't think the American military is the solution, the truth is we never went to Afghanistan for that reason. In fact, as you mentioned, we helped craft the problem. So let's say if you take like women's rights and human rights, I mean, the United States is saying, oh, when, you know, the areas we were under control of, you know, women had a lot more rights than ever before, more schooling, more opportunity to be in public life. They were even in parliament. Guess who else that was true for? The Soviets. Turns out that communists are often feminists. And they were the most modern places to be were often in the Soviet controlled areas, which is not an advocation for their invasion. And it was brutal the way they bombed the Mujahideen. But the United States was knowingly, because there were like executions in front of CIA agents by these warlords and Mujahideen militia members that we were backing.
And gave Viagra to so it could encourage their rape of young men.
Yeah, I mean, the rape culture is real, especially among these warlords. Part of why the Taliban forms is these guys were so venal. And America was often backing the most reactionary, you know, women suppressing, human rights suppressing elements in order to give the Soviets their Vietnam in a vengeful sort of but unnecessary way, really, in the long arc of history. And that kind of does produce the Taliban, because some of those Mujahideen coalesce into the Taliban, and some of why the Taliban forms was in reaction to the brutality of these warlords who were fighting a chaotic civil war. So the Afghan people would prefer the stoic sort of dogmatic Islamism of the Taliban, because at least they get law and order, versus the chaos of the venal warlords. I mean, it's not to say that either of those groups is preferable, but this is how it is understood on the ground in crisis, and it's hard for Americans to understand. So as we go back, I find it very disingenuous when people start the clock at 2001, or they start the clock at 2019, or they start the clock a week ago when Kabul is falling and say, look what happened. You really have to start the clock when America got involved and understand our own complicity in it. This was never about women's rights. This was never about human rights. It was about vengeance, geopolitics, power, and it has ever been thus. That doesn't mean we don't have responsibilities to the Afghans who work for us. It means we should be honest about what got us in so that we can be honest about whether we should stay, whether we should go, and the nature of our getting out.
Well, that's a pretty sorry report card on I should mention, I don't know if he's still professor at USC where I happen to teach, Professor Petraeus. I should have checked that before. But it's a pretty sorry report card anyway. And I want to thank you, Danny Shorson. You served. You were part of the boots on the ground in both Iraq and Afghanistan, taking orders from David Petraeus. And I just really wonder whether journalists who interview that man even know how we got into Afghanistan any more than how we got into Vietnam in the first place. It just seems to be an absence of history. And I have compared your book to the great work by Howard Zinn, The People's History. And Danny Shorson, that book is out. So I hope people read it and get familiar with the whole history, really, of U.S. militarism going back to to colonialist times. That's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence. I want to thank Christopher Ho at KCRW for hosting these shows, our host station. Joshua Shear, who is the executive producer of Sheer Intelligence. Natasha Hakimi-Zapata, who writes the intro. Lucy Berbio, who does the transcription. With a special shout out to the JWK Foundation, which in the name of late writer Gene Stein, terrific writer, helps fund these shows. See you next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence. Rien de rien, non, je ne regrette rien, c'est payé.